Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
All right, thank you. And I guess Morton's laid out this wonderful theoretical framework, and I guess I am following with a case study. So I think it's nice to be able to start this way, and I'm going to give a specific example. I modified my title a little bit as I was doing my research and writing my paper. I wanted to emphasize the fact that Nahimana is a very central figure to the Rwandan genocide, and I think that's very important for my paper. So referring to him as the Rwandan Goebbels, I thought, got more to the point. And I also added Tokyo in addition to Nuremberg. So with that, let me give you my overview. I'm going to talk about the Nahimana case. And then talk about Theodore Marone, which we'll see he plays an important part in my paper. I'll then look at the appeals decision in the Nahimana case, otherwise known as the media trial. And then some controversies that Marone has courted or did court after the appeals decision, and then Nahimana coming to Marone at the MICT, the International Mechanism for the International Criminal Tribunals, applying for early release. And so when we look at that, I'm going to reflect a little bit on U.S. policy vis-a-vis war criminals at Nuremberg and Tokyo and their early release, and then I'll have some concluding thoughts. So, Nahimana, I'm going to try to zip through these early slides. Let me just emphasize that he was, in my view, one of the architects of the Rwandan genocide. He was an historian. His expertise was overlooked Hutu, pre-colonial Hutu kingdoms, and the idea that Tutsis were alien to Rwanda, latecomers, if you will. He had a history of discriminatory policies and hatred toward the Tutsis. I detail all this in my paper. One of the key incidents that I detail early on is he's made head of the Rwandan Office for Information, where he has control over Radio Rwanda, which is the national radio station. And in March 1992, in this role, he has disseminated a false communique which leads to the massacre of Tutsis in the Bugesera region. Because of this, he is fired, and then he goes on to work with Hutu extremists to set up a radio station that the extremists control. That's not linked to the government, which is now a power-sharing government, and that is called Radio Télévision Libre des Mille Collines, RTLM, which runs from the middle of 1993 through the end of the Rwandan genocide, which takes place during April to July 1994. In the paper, again, I show how Nahimana had control over RTLM. I won't go into the nitty-gritty details of that now. It'll come up a little bit when I talk about the trial and appeals decisions. But he got notice very clearly of the fact that RTLM was disseminating a message of hatred. And yet, as a key leader, if not the leader, of RTLM and its content, he continued on with this kind of content through the beginning of the genocide. And then during the genocide, as demonstrated at trial and as I show in my paper, he continued to exercise de facto control over RTLM. So we have a very interesting setup in terms of when we finally get to his trial, this evidence that I go over then becomes central to the judgment, which was delivered by Judge Pile in December 2003, and I quote her, "The broadcasts collectively conveyed a message of ethnic hatred and a call for violence against the Tutsi population. As the mastermind of RTLM, Nahimana set in motion the communications weaponry that fought, quote, the war of media words, newspapers, and radio stations," he described in his Radio Rwanda broadcast of 25 April as a complement to bullets. Nahimana also expressed his intent through RTLM, where the words broadcast were intended to kill on the basis of ethnicity, and that is what they did. As a result of this, he was sentenced to life in prison. Now, we've set all that up. Now in the paper, I look at Judge Theodore Marone and begin with his incredible story, really, being born as in a Jewish family in Poland in 1930, who lost most of his family to the Holocaust, survived, went to what would become Israel, and was educated at Harvard and Cambridge in the late 1950s. He worked for the Israeli Foreign Ministry in various posts for about 20 years and advised against settlements in territory taken after the Six-Day War. I throw that tidbit out for you because I think for Maroon defenders that's important. He becomes a law professor at NYU in 1977 and works extensively with the U.S. State Department. He's a counselor on international law issues and goes on many missions, including the Rome Conference in 1998. And in 2001, the U.S. nominates him as a judge to the appeals chamber of the ICTY, and he would be president of the ICTY on two separate occasions, from 2003 to 2005 and from 2011 to 2015. Now, we've got this introduction to Judge Maroon. Nahimana appeals, as does Baraguiza and Ngeze, the two co-defendants in the media trial. Now, the key conviction grounds against Nahimana were upheld, and we see Judge Pokar here in the image. But the pre-1994 broadcasts of RTLM, right? It was set up in mid-1993. There were broadcasts that went up through 1994 and the genocide. Those were thrown out, as well as convictions premised on Article 6.1 liability. And for those of you who are familiar with the ICTR statute, you know that Article 6.1 deals with direct commission liability. 6.3 deals with the superior responsibility. And in fact, his convictions for incitement to genocide and persecution as a crime against humanity were upheld pursuant to Article 6.3 liability. In other words, he was the superior of the RTLM announcers. And given the partial reversal of some of the parts of the conviction, his sentence was reduced to 30 years. All right, now, we have this basic setup. Now, in the background, there is this real push, I would say, by American jurists to make sure that the appeals chamber understands that there's a problem with the trial chamber's judgment, and it's grounded in First Amendment principles. And we can understand this best by the Open Society Institute, which files an amicus brief with the American position front and center. It offers, of course, American jurisprudence the most robust protection for public expression of inimical ideas. It flows from the First Amendment, which says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And the idea is premised on the marketplace of ideas trope. In other words, that the best way to go is to allow for a clash of accounts and the truth will out. It is governed by the standard set out in Brandenburg versus Ohio from 1969, which only prescribes advocacy that is directed to producing imminent lawless action and is likely to produce such action. Hate speech not explicitly calling for action should not be criminalized, and the defendant's liability then should be based on, it was based on that according to the amicus brief. And then that helps us contextualize Judge Maroon's dissent, which I'll get to in a moment. But another point which is essential is that the Americans have tried to promote this free speech ethos on the international plane. They try to exclude without success an incitement provision in the Genocide Convention, and then in negotiations for the ICCPR, they zealously countered inclusion of Article 22, which prohibits hate advocacy. All right, so again, with that context in mind, we can look at Judge Maroon's dissent. There are two aspects of the dissent that I'd like to focus on. First of all, his problem with hate speech as persecution as one of the grounds of liability for Nahimana. He says in his dissent, under any circumstances, quote, mere hate speech may not be the basis of a criminal conviction. Only when hate speech rises to the level of inciting violence or other imminent lawless action can it be criminalized. And then he cites the U.S. Constitution, and I underline the fact that he's citing the U.S. Constitution, and he says that the value he talks about the value of protecting hate speech and alludes to American values that cherish the benefit of protecting political dissent. Now, in my recent book, Atrocity Speech Law, which was put out by Oxford University Press a couple months ago, There is a lot of discussion about why I think this is a problematic view. Be that as it may, this was Judge Marone's view. And the second part of it, in other words, his dissent, is that he would have remanded for a new trial, given the extent of appellate revision. And this is ironic in light of Godovina, which I'll talk about in a moment. And despite the severity of this crime, and I quote him, Nahimana did not personally kill anyone and did not personally make statements that constituted incitement. In light of these facts, I believe that the sentence imposed is too harsh. Now, let's think about this for a second. He wanted a remand, and he thought the sentence was too harsh, and he felt that fully half the grounds for liability, if not more, were invalid. Okay, so this all kind of sets us up. Now, as I said in my outline, controversy would come. Now, Nahimana himself ultimately is transferred to Mali in 2008. And in 2008, as Nahimana is being transferred to Mali, the trial of Ante Godovina is going on before the ICTY. He is ultimately convicted for ethnic cleansing of the Serb enclave in Croatia during Operation Torch, which, by the way, was supported by the United States, as I point out in my paper. The trial chamber adopted a 200-meter standard to determine if shelling was indiscriminate in that case. That was rejected by the appeals chamber. But rather than look at the totality of the evidence and enter convictions on alternate liability modes or remand the case, remember my point about irony given the Nahimana decision, the appeals chamber, with Judge Marone presiding, threw out the convictions in their entirety. Now, following that, we have the Perisic case from 2013. He was a Serb security police head, and the trial chamber conviction here was primarily based on aiding and abetting. And this was overturned by the appeals chamber, again, Judge Marone presiding, because such liability, they held, only attaches if it was, quote, specifically directed to the commission of crimes, in other words, the aid, as part of the actus reus. And this supposedly was from a comment made in Tadic in the 1999 appeals judgment. Now, both decisions, presided over again by Judge Marone, drew blistering dissents and were widely criticized by experts, with the specific direction element being rejected by the appeals chambers at the SCSL in the Taylor case and by the ICTY itself in Sanovich. More controversy, the Frederick Harhoff letter. Several months later, a Danish newspaper obtained the email of ICTY Danish judge Frederick Harhoff. This was sent in confidence to friends. It was not meant for public consumption. He talks about Godovina and Perisic and other acquittals, which he says were the result of political pressure on Judge Marone exercised by the U.S. and Israel. In turn, per Judge Harhoff, Marone influenced his fellow judges to increase the threshold of complicity so as to make convictions more difficult. The idea being that the U.S. In particular, which has a lot of military obligations around the world, would not want its leaders to be subject or its soldiers to be subject to such a low threshold. And in the words of Judge Harhoff, I quote, reports of the same American presiding judge's tenacious pressure on his colleagues in the Godovina-Perisic case makes you think he was determined to achieve an acquittal, and especially that he was lucky enough to convince the elderly Turkish judge, who, by the way, was then 77-year-old Mehmet Guni, to change his mind at the last minute. So the letter generated a firestorm of controversy, and Judge Harhoff, as we know, was ultimately removed from the ICTY bench. Now, there's more to the controversy. Then there was a WikiLeaks cable leak. The public then learned via WikiLeaks of earlier cables wherein Marone and American officials seemingly colluded to cause UN action regarding prosecutorial replacement, selection, tribunal case strategy, and resource allocation. Article 16.2, of course, of the ICTY statute provides that the prosecutor shall act independently as a separate organ of the International Tribunal. And in light of this, I quote Kevin Heller in the paper, who notes that Judge Marone's secret meetings with the U.S. ambassador was inconsistent with any of the OTP's independence. Indeed, it was a frontal assault on it. And then in an article titled, "Did a Supporter of International Criminal Law Turn into a Stooge of the U.S.?" journalist Martin Burchard suggests the cables corroborate Harhoff's allegations against Marone. The piece concludes with a former legal advisor to the tribunal stating, and I quote, "The perception among my colleagues is that Marone takes instructions from the U.S. government and that this reining in of the legal standards as we have seen with the acquittals, would have implications for the U.S., and WikiLeaks does not help him. All right, again, things are set up because then the U.S. nominates Marone to the MICT. The U.S. obviously has a huge role in the creation of the MICT in the first place, and it continues, of course, the jurisdiction and the rights and obligations of the ICTR and the ICTY. And it has branches in Arusha for the ICTR and The Hague for the ICTY. Again, Marone is nominated as the U.S. judge, and he ultimately, and we don't know exactly what went on behind the scenes, but he becomes president of the MICT, as he had been president so much of the ICTY. So it turns out that the president is the one that makes decisions about release of prisoners, early release of prisoners who've been convicted by the ICTY and the ICTR. So we're set up again. Nahimana comes back into the picture, and Nahimana now requests early release. He files an application, and it goes before Marone. And in a December 2016 decision, which, by the way, is heavily redacted, which is kind of fishy in and of itself, Marone decides to release Nahimana. Now, I'm going to analyze the decision here in a moment, but apart from the obvious conflict of interest, appearance of impropriety of having Judge Marone decide on the application unilaterally, given his issues with Nahimana's guilt and sentence as a member of the Merits Appellate Panel, there are other issues, and I will discuss them. To understand them, let's first look at the relevant rules. Rule 150 of the MICT RPE provides, and I quote, "The president shall, upon such notice, determine, in consultation with any judges of the sentencing chamber who are judges of the mechanism, whether pardon, commutation of sentence, or early release is appropriate." And then Rule 151 declares, "In determining whether pardon, commutation of sentence, or early release is appropriate, the president shall take into account, inter alia, the gravity of the crime or crimes for which the prisoner was convicted, the treatment of similarly situated prisoners, the prisoner's demonstration of rehabilitation, as well as any substantial cooperation of the prisoner with the prosecutor." Running through those, looking at the gravity of crimes, Judge Marone acknowledges that Nahimana was an architect of the genocide. He acknowledges his role in founding and shaping RTLM, and quotes the trial chamber that without a firearm, machete, or any physical weapon, Nahimana caused the death of thousands of innocent civilians, and for this he bore superior responsibility as he failed to use his de facto power and authority to prevent the genocidal harm caused by the broadcast. It is remarkable that the decision begins with this, and when you see what follows. He then looks at the next 151 analysis, which is similarly situated prisoners. And here his analysis is terse and superficial. And I quote him, "In this respect, I recall that ICTR convicts like Nahimana are considered similarly situated to all other prisoners under the mechanism supervision, and that all convicts supervised by the mechanism are to be considered eligible for early release upon the completion of two-thirds of their sentences, irrespective of the tribunal that convicted them. And there is no legal authority cited for this, he just asserts it." He backs it up with a footnote, footnote 30, in which he cites two other cases, prosecutor versus Borovchenin and prosecutor versus Besenimanga. And those two were released after serving two-thirds of their sentences. Now, if we look at those particular defendants, Borovchenin had a relatively minor role linked to July 1995 incidents in Bosnia, during which he was a deputy commander of a police brigade, aiding and abetting forcible transfer of civilians out of Pukhari and failing to punish subordinates who took part in killing prisoners in front of a warehouse in Kravica. And then prosecutor versus Besenimanga, he was a mayor of a town called Gikoro in the Kigali rural prefecture of Rwanda. He pled guilty to aiding and abetting crimes against humanity, murder, extermination against Tutsis between 13 and 15 April 1994, and he expressed genuine contrition. Now, we're going to compare this to Nahimana. It's pretty remarkable because the next part of the analysis is demonstration of rehabilitation. Marone merely cites reports from Mali prison officials that Nahimana has been cooperative and lives in harmony with his fellow prisoners. But what stands out is the sentence that follows that, and I quote, "He has disputed his own responsibility for the crimes of genocide." Now contrast that with Besenimanga and Borovchenin, who But Sangimana pled guilty, and Borovchukhanin did not appeal. And I would note that in my own research, I have found on the internet Nahimana in a tract where he talks about how everybody else is to blame but himself. He's not guilty, he was framed, et cetera, et cetera. That's not even cited in the decision. Then there's talk of substantial cooperation, and Maron has to acknowledge that Nahimana did not substantially cooperate. He didn't cooperate at all. But he says it's a neutral factor in determining whether or not to grant him early release. And then remember, finally, Rule 150, consultation with other judges. He only deals with this briefly in a footnote and says, other than myself, none of the judges of the sentencing chamber are judges of the mechanism. On that basis, no consultations with other judges of the mechanism pursuant to Rule 150 of the rules are required in determining this application. Now here, he hangs his hat on a technicality. It's true that no member of the sentencing bench is currently on the MICT roster, which is just a group of judges that are not even paid full time. They're just available if they need to be used. But Judge Fausto Pocar, who I alluded to earlier, who is a member of the sentencing panel who disagreed with Maron, is still a judge on the ICTY, as is Maron himself. It would have been quite feasible to solicit Judge Pocar's views, given the close structural and personal link between the ICTY and the MICT, and this is especially true given Maron's conflict of interest. The other thing that I want to point out is the two-thirds sentence eligibility rule. There is no statutory support for it. It was simply a practice adopted by the judges at the ad hoc tribunals. I should say two-thirds was adopted at the ICTY, but given the genocidal focus of crimes at the ICTR, it had a different practice from the ICTY. It used a three-quarter standard, but Maron simply unilaterally switched the ICTR prisoners to the two-thirds standard in the Besigimana early release decision. It's just a couple sentences in the middle of the decision. Nobody's talked about that. He just does it unilaterally. And because the early release policy is counter to the intention of the ad hoc framers, it's important that we highlight this because it's adopted something like a presumption that prisoners need only serve two-thirds of their sentences, apparently out of confusion between commutation and parole, right? Domestic actors grant commutation much less often than they do parole. And now I'm getting to my final thoughts, which the ghost of the Nuremberg Tokyo commutations. I close with reflections on how Maron's position as an American with absolute and sole authority to make early release decisions of major war criminals based on uniquely American policy preferences can remind us of Americans in a similar situation after World War II, in particular, John J. McCloy in Germany and Douglas MacArthur in Japan. Based on Cold War political considerations, McCloy released serious war criminals such as Einsatzgruppe leader Martin Sandberger and industrialists such as slave labor user Alfred Krupp as early as 1951, and MacArthur was releasing IMTFE convicts as early as 1948. If Justice Robert Jackson was correct in his IMT opening statement that in bringing Axis war criminals to book, quote, the real complaining party at the bar is civilization, then McCloy and MacArthur were custodians for global aspirations and values, and their commutations look like breaches of a fiduciary duty to humanity. And the same, I would submit to you, is true of Maron's decision on Nahimana. So the issue of the relationship between Judge Maron's American First Amendment sensibilities and the early release of Ferdinand Nahimana has been a fascinating portal through which to explore the often fraught dynamic between national interests and international justice. But frankly, my dear friends and colleagues, this paper raises other important issues about post-incarceration justice. Why is one person alone allowed to make a unilateral decision concerning the liberty of someone convicted by the international community of committing ICL offenses? Even if a one-person unilateral decision is in the best interest of justice, should that person be the same one who sat on the appellate merits panel, especially when in dissent of the sentence's harshness? What doctrine or policy justifies the two-thirds mark release eligibility in the first place? Should ICTR defendants have continued to be held to the ICTR's three-quarters eligibility standard? And let me just remind you that Theones Bagasora, the genocide's chief architect, could be released in 5 years under this policy because he's similarly situated to Mayor Besigimana. Should there be more due process and transparency in early release decisions, including hearings where prosecutors, victims, and other witnesses can be heard? Should a prisoner release analysis unit be set up within the MICT? I close with these questions, and I close here today with the hope that you all will spread the word about what's going on, because if American policy preferences don't get honored on the front end, it doesn't make any sense at all that on the back end, in the shadows, that international criminal justice should be thwarted. We need to shine a light on that, and we need to make sure that justice continues through the arc of the entire process. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to SILRAP.org.